Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Friday, November 8th, 2024, a cloudy and cool fall day here in Nashville. I am back for a new season of podcasts after taking some time off to travel and getting my frame of mind back in a better place. Thanks, as always, to Ron Trammell for our fun intro music. That's my buddy Ron on the guitar. International travel is a real privilege. We recently had a visit to Ireland, and what a wonderful experience. I will testify that driving on the wrong side of the road is not as challenging as one might think. My guest today, Michael Officer, comes to us as a consequence of our visit to the beautiful city of Galway in Western Ireland, and to their annual Oyster Festival. Michael is the energetic director of the Cooin Bio organization. More about that name in the interview. We will hear from Michael about their ongoing efforts to restore the oyster fishery in the Galway Bay. They are using a multifaceted approach involving assuring the high water quality and appropriate volumes of fresh water entering the bay, along with positive measures to improve available habitat for oysters. Here is wishing everyone a peaceful Thanksgiving holiday, and we will get started with our interview right after this short message.
Hi, this is Heather Lose, Editor-in-Chief of the Tennessee Conservationist Magazine. Every year, we publish six beautiful issues packed full of timely and informative stories about Tennessee culture, people, and places. You can stay informed about your world and all the great things happening in your Tennessee state parks. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website at tnconservationist.org. Thank you.
Michael Officer, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Hi, Mark. Delighted to be here. It's great that we managed this after your trip to Ireland. So it's really great to be here. Thanks.
Well, it was fun. It's always fun to visit Ireland. I've been three times now, and it was a real treat to meet you at the Galway Oyster Festival. I went to that festival anticipating oysters, of course, and music and dancing and that sort of thing. But I did not expect to encounter the likes of a conservationist with a booth promoting their activities. So it was fun to meet you, and thank you for being so cordial at that meeting and chatting this talky American up a little bit.
Oh, it was great to meet you. So the Oyster Festival has a long, colorful history, and that's there was the shucking contest, but our involvement there comes with it the oyster restoration in Galway Bay, native oyster restoration.
And I want to dig into that in a big way in our conversation today. First of all, you are we're recording this with the assistance of Zoom internationally, and I've done a couple of those international recordings in the past, and it's always a treat to do. But have to say that we had an ill-fated attempt to do this interview last week, which was confounded by the 6-hour time change with the complexity of the change to daylight savings time, and you and I got our wires crossed. So thank you for your patience and getting this organized.
It was very, I was on the way back from a meeting, and as I'm coming back, I see a few emails saying, here's the Zoom link, just seeing if you're coming. And I was there going, oh Jesus, 4 o'clock, 5. Oh, and then I looked at the time, as you said.
Well, I was exasperated.
Daylight savings.
Anyway, so you are presently in Galway or in Dublin?
I'm in Galway. So I'm working in Galway, and that's on the west coast of Ireland for your listeners. So we work on a kind of catchment approach. So we're in a county, and that is also another county as well in Clare, which is just south of Galway.
South of Galway. And what's the weather there like today?
Unusually warm.
Yes.
Yesterday, I was meeting a person, and I had two options of a cafe. And I said, "Oh, I'm going to go to the one which is warm, which is outside seating, because it was 17 degrees." And on the 6th of November yesterday, that's very unusual in
Yes,
Ireland.
it's been
So we
warm
sat
here.
outside. I had a lovely cycle to it, loads of birds chirping away as if it was a summer's evening. And
Right.
then we sat outside for 2 hours and didn't even notice. I didn't get cold, and I normally get very cold. So
Yeah,
yeah,
we've had
we're
a
having.
warm and dry falls so far this year. It's going to be 70 degrees Fahrenheit today, with a little bit of drizzle. In any case, Michael, you are the executive of an organization called Cuanbio, and this is an Irish phrase, which I'm becoming Irish and Gaelic la language phrase, which I'm just becoming acquainted with. Tell us about the origin of that name, and what does that mean?
So the origin of the name there, it's Cúin Bio. So Cúin in Irish means bay or harbor. And BO means living or live. So the idea is it's a live bay or a living bay. And I suppose that reflects the beginnings of Cúin BO and really trying to get people around the table and see what we can do to improve the vitality of Galway Bay and the communities that it kind of serves, and the communities that help it as well. So the idea was, it's all the interested parties, and kind of I guess it revolved around oysters in that way, at least initially. But that's the general idea there, a
Right.
living bay.
And how long have you been affiliated with this organization?
Well, myself, I'm
Yes.
here only 6 months now, but
Okay.
funnily enough, 7 years ago, when the Cúin BO was founded, I found myself at its establishing meeting, by not by accident, but I was much younger, and I didn't know what I really didn't know what the organization was. I was rather naive and unaware, and then I was in Dublin, in Ireland's capital, for a couple of years, and then I came back for this job. I kind of remembered as I was applying for the job, geez, I was at this I was at the founding of this NGO. So it's quite a nice circularity to it.
So interesting. I was looking at your biography, and your training is at Trinity College in Dublin. Is that right?
Yes,
Tell us
that's
about that a
correct.
little bit.
Funnily enough, when I was deciding which route I was going on the last day in Ireland, you choose your kind of college courses if that's what you choose to do. And on the last day, I chose I had engineering down, and I decided, oh no, I'm going to switch to biological and biomedical sciences. So I studied biological and biomedical sciences in Trinity College Dublin. And in the first 2 years, it's a broad spectrum of kind of genetics up to environmental science and neuroscience, biochemistry, all of the different interests. And then you specialize at the end. So I chose zoology, and that has a flavor of botany and environmental science in it too.
Right.
And within the zoology, I suppose I never focused on one particular area. I was kind of broad. I liked the transferability of concepts, or at least practices, two different species or two different areas. So it was quite a, I kind of approached it in a broad way, whereas other people might be more interested in a particular species.
Right.
And I appreciate that, but I suppose that was never my thing.
And in your upbringing, what were the influences that you believe caused you or inspired you to choose an occupation in the field of conservation work?
It's a funny one, Mark. I kind of have thought about it before, and there's a lot of different factors there. I suppose there's a mix of kind of interest in family and extended family. And some of those are science and environmental. There's always a kind of horticulture in my own kind of immediate family, and I was always interested in gardening and the likes and being out and hiking.
Excellent.
And I suppose there was also, I certainly enjoyed the Lord of the Rings and things, and that kind of connection with nature in certain ways. I wouldn't say that influenced me to go into zoology now, but it certainly, there was something there anyways. And then there was never any kind of pressure or direction from my immediate family in any way to pursue anything. But I suppose the what brought me down the route of zoology and the environment, I would say it's probably a sense of concern and duty to do so. When I kind of look at the immediate problems of our time and the challenges, and I would have thought and the environment was an overarching one for both human and life in general, for all life. So
Well,
I thought,
well stated for sure. That's super. Tell us a little bit about Galway Bay and the its circumstance. Obviously, if it was healthy on its own without organizations getting involved to make improvements, it found itself in some sort of a state of needing repair. So what were those conditions, and what were the causes of that? Can you go into some detail about that?
So I can approach it in two different ways. So I'll firstly say Galway itself, Galway Bay, without Cumbio's perspective. So Galway is a really diverse bay area. So for seaweed, now I'm going to underestimate this so that I don't overestimate it,
Okay.
but there's been over 350 species of seaweed found in Galway Bay, from my
Wow.
understanding now, and that's one of the most diverse in Europe. There were reported, there's seagrass beds, there's oyster beds, there's nursery grounds of all sorts. It's fed into by multiple different river systems. So the Corrib Lake, Lough Corrib, which you would have probably seen on your travels, flowing through Galway City. I think that river is very short, but it's the fastest flowing river in Europe. At that point, as far as I'm aware. And then there's multiple other rivers coming from the east and the south. So there's really fascinating geology in Galway feeding in there. There's karst landscape, limestone karst landscape. So there's groundwater, normal kind of freshwater rivers as well. So it's all sorts of different upstream catchments that are flowing into Galway Bay, and it
Right.
creates a really interesting circulation system within it, different habitats. And within that, then the native oyster, Ostrea edulis, has grown in Galway Bay for thousands of years. There are multiple beds around Ireland, and the native oyster then has grown there for thousands of years and has been harvested similarly for at least hundreds anyways of years. And this oyster bed, particularly in our Galway Bay now, has in recent times been depleted for multiple reasons. So for example, there would be changes in disease dynamics. There's a disease called Benamia, and that's your Benamia, it's European wide. And that kind of reduces maturity. They struggle to reach maturity and a marketable size.
This is a fungal disease, a bacteriological.
It's kind of parasite, protozoa. So it gets in, and it kind of reduces their ability to reach a 4 or 5 years,
Okay.
which is generally the age at which they were sold. And eaten. So then there was also kind of changes in upstream river management that increased fresh water flows into oyster bed areas, and so say that reduces the salinity, and mixed with higher temperatures, it creates a very stressed environment. So really, I think Cumbio, the founders, and the interested parties were, for the most part, oyster fishers and marine biologists. And it was really looking at how to provide a more hospitable area for them to be growing and for them to thrive. So that involves upstream river management, and then immediate measurements inside the oyster bed areas.
Well, say more about that. You know, the casual listener might not understand that oysters require just the right mix of salt water and fresh water to survive. Say more about that.
Oysters are quite unique. They actually, you'd say, oh, minimize the fresh water or whichever, or don't let them get too polluted. I've anecdotally now, some people have said, oh, if nutrients are a problem, how did they have such big beds years ago when there was less pollution? And I once heard someone say, poor domestic sewage. And it was, they love the nutrients to a certain extent. That doesn't license mass pollution, but it does mean that a lot of the time it's poor freshwater overflows. I'll rephrase that now. For storm events, having a high surge of fresh water flowing down a river or off a landscape means that the water that the oysters are in is desalinated, it reduces its salinity, and then say if it's warm at the same time, it stresses the oysters, and they may die or they may have the reduced capacity to reproduce. So there's this balance, that they like to reproduce and then also just to continue growing.
I should say for our listeners, there's a similar situation going on in North America, looking at the area called Apalachicola Bay in Northwest Florida, which is one of the premier places where oysters are harvested in the Southeast U.S. The Apalachicola River flows from the north into that shallow bay, and the city of Atlanta is actually using the water that ends up in that river to such an extent that it's reducing the freshwater influx to the bay and affecting the oyster harvest there, to the extent that there actually was a lawsuit brought by, I think, the state of Florida was the party involved, that went to the United States Supreme Court, and unfortunately was not a good outcome for the oysters. But I think that there are people there that are trying to do their best to manage the situation. But so that's not unique to Ireland that situation is happening.
No, yeah, and it's interesting one because I wouldn't say Ireland, there's no shortage of rainfall here,
That's for
but
sure.
that doesn't mean there's no shortage of water for homes. There's still a need to conserve water in homes, just for people, just to reduce the amount of processing that has to happen for water treatment systems as well, and with wastewater as well. There's when there's overflow events that will also impact the health of the bay, aquaculture farmers. It'll increase the levels of E. coli and other bacterial diseases or bacteria in shellfish. So it's this perfect balance. In a way, I would say oyster beds are a great way of incentivizing better upstream river management and indeed better transitional water river management. So by restoring oysters, or at least aiming to, you kind of require better practices on all fronts. So it's quite an effective way of achieving that.
All right, well, let's talk about those better practices. I bet you spend a lot of your time out encouraging landowners to have best practices And what are those? And tell us about your techniques of involving yourself with them.
Yeah, so it comes in different forms. There are so many people to involve. Sometimes reaching up into the catchment is quite difficult, and we certainly find that. And being a coastal, for the most part, we work on a catchment approach, but our current focus, and our current expertise is mostly on the coast and involving aquaculture farmers, who often are also terrestrial farmers as well. They mix. There might be people who used to fish the oyster bed, and they would also be farming cattle or sheep. So in terms of that, I'd say there's an example here. We're now moving into freshwater management, actually getting involved in projects that are changing improving freshwater systems. And there's a current project we're applying for. It's small enough, but the aim would be working with the farmers whose land bridges the river, whose land is adjacent to the river, and looking at what measures could be done to reduce runoff into the river. So that could be tree planting along the river's edge. It could be putting in dams to reduce the immediate flow of water off farmers' land, or it could be putting in mounds to soak up excess water or reeds. Just the usual kind of nature-based solutions, which won't impact productivity of the farmer. In fact, it might even benefit productivity. But I think the main thing is doing what they're also interested in, because it's their land ultimately, and it all has to happen with their consent and their support. This project that we hope will be successful, it's due in 2 weeks now. If this was successful, it'd be a great way of kind of involving more farmers in the next one, or moving on to the next river system that is a bigger beast to manage. They get very complex very quickly, and different land morphologies and all the rest. So it's I'm not sure if I've answered your question there, Mark, but it can be challenging to get far into the catchment, especially with an NGO when we're trying to scale. So in some ways we stick with what we can manage well. And a lot of the time that would be along the coast, and advocating
So in
what we.
your analysis of the catchment area, river basin area or watershed area, we would say in the United States, are you able to particularize points of concern that you're focused on? I mean, obviously, there may well, not obviously, there may be particular farmers or particular places on the landscape that are your highest priority. Have you been able to do that kind of analysis?
Yeah, so fortunately that analysis has been done for us by other people in their remits anyways. So the Environmental Protection Agency in Ireland, and what's called the Local Authority Waters Programme in Ireland, and they have river analyses completed where they indicate the pressures for each river system. There's a great interface where they have every river system in Ireland, every pressure for each river system, and every an indicated risk of reduced water quality for those river systems. So we can see for Galway what's green, what's orange, what's red. You can imagine what those mean accordingly. And for our current one that we're looking at, it's a small river, and it's orange. So it's not red, but what we're looking to do is kind of show what we could do on this orange one if we apply it to maybe a red or another orange, which may be a longer river. And there are certain points at which it goes from orange to red, and it's mainly bringing those people on board in a way that they don't feel demonized or any way like that. It's kind of what can be a positive outcome for everyone involved.
So you have some interesting encounters with the actual human beings on the landscape out there?
Yes, sure. Rewilding and re restoration is easy, Mark. It's the it can be public kind of. It's always going to be. There's so many different interests and economic, social, traditional interests that are very fair. It's fair to have. I have my own interests, but it's kind of getting the best outcome for everyone. So, in that way, having a scheme where farmers are either compensated or even paid to do the work. If there's measures recommended for a certain area, it would be great to have the farmer involved and give them a sense of ownership of that work. So for the restoration itself, the native oyster bed that's there, the harvesting of oysters from that has been closed for several years, and in the restoration work itself, the people who are involved are the people who would have previously fished it. So it's giving that sense of ownership as well, and a lot of it may sometimes be a traditional practice of farming the oyster bed rather than an economic incentive. There's certainly an economic incentive, but a lot of it is retaining that sense of connection to the oyster fishing.
Tell us a little bit more about the practicality of building that oyster population back up to a place where it can be sustainably harvested. I remember being at the Oyster Festival. There was one a vendor there who had an abundance of product there for people to sample, and he was obviously engaged in the culture of oysters, rather than harvesting naturally occurring ones. Tell us about all that, and how are you seeding new beds, and tell us about the practicality of all that.
So fortunately, in Galway Bay, we have a residual population there that's already reproducing. In other locations, sometimes they no longer have a reproducing population, so they are literally starting from scratch and seeding it. In our case, what's lacking to a certain extent is shell. So shell for spat to settle on, oyster spat to settle on, and then grow. So what we do then is we deploy the shell onto the sediment, or onto, we have two different areas, three different areas. We have two kind of small reefs that are kind of dense gatherings of shell material. So those are different types of shell, and those are kind of trying to create a reef structure with structural complexity and heterogeneity of all different kind of habitats in there, and opportunities for different species to get in. And then we also have a bed, which is kind of a scattered deployment of shell, that would kind of have a residual population, that could then populate the reef, or the reef could actually populate this bed. So far, there's been different types of shell deployed. It could be razor shell, Pacific rock oyster shell, which is farmed as aquaculture here. There's also scallop shell, and they're deployed in different ways. So far, there's been different estimations. Some of it has been kind of experimentation of what shell is most effective. But about 800 tons of
Goodness.
shell. And it's not a large area either. There's a lot of shell, about 800 tons,
So where
of
does
which
one
probably
go on the market to acquire 800 tons of shell?
all sorts of ways of getting. No, it's all very much a regulated thing here. So there'd be scallop shell fisheries, that would have shell after processing, and we would get it from there. The person you're speaking of at Galway International Oyster Festival, he would also have shell that would then go back out from that oyster festival. There were tons of shells collected, and they're all going back on out on the reef, or they're going to other kind of people who are actually interested in what they can make out of shell material. So there's all sorts of we'd love the idea of a kind of waste circularity process where used shell goes back out into restoration processes, and ideally it would be oysters, but at the moment we're using were using Pacific rock oyster shell, scallop shell, and they're very effective. In fact, they might not even have a better settlement rate. But it would be nice to, once the reef hopefully gets going, hopefully it would be a native oyster, self-perpetuating,
And then
reef
do
structure.
you once the shell is down, do you seed with native oysters, or you just let nature take its course?
Yeah, so at the moment we're letting nature take its course because
Mm-hmm.
there's a population large enough that it is
Gotcha,
seeding.
gotcha,
So
gotcha.
far we've had a 20 million increase approximately in native
Fantastic.
oyssters. And that we'll be assessing that again now based on this year's reproductive cycle. And also we'll be assessing over the last 4 years what level of oysters have reached maturity from the first year we did it back in 2020, 2021, I think. And I think early on there were different experiments made of kind of seeding and different approaches. But we've kind of now with the deployments of shell in the summers, they're kind of always timed based on temperatures, based on winds. But it kind of has to move a little each year for the best time for settling before reproduction. So that reproduction happens and then they'll be settled on within a few weeks.
And are there specific areas of the bay that are dedicated to purposeful aquaculture?
Yeah, to aquaculture, where the oyster reef is, where kind of the Inagoi Bay Restoration Project, around there's quite a few Pacific rock oyster aquaculture
Okay,
farms.
okay.
And also, mussels further into to go in Convara Bay, just south with still within Galway Bay. So there are the person you met there, Dermot Kelly, would have had his own aquaculture set up in
Right,
Galway Bay.
right, right. And you know, and the oyster is a natural water cleaning device, so to speak. Those oysters, when they're going, they will process a lot of water and clean the water as they live.
Yeah, indeed. They're rather effective already. I wouldn't give a figure because it kind of actually changes by location and their capacity to even remove nutrients. So they're keystone species in providing habitat and nursery grounds. So habitat for seagrass beds, which in turn are nursery grounds, habitat for all sorts of different fauna and flora, all sorts. It's a really vibrant place. We're hoping to assess the actual biodiversity down there now. So far it's been quite anecdotal, the increases. So we're hoping to assess what's really
Super.
happening down there.
You know, Michael, many of my listeners are involved in outdoor recreation. They're park managers and people involved in our state parks and national parks here in the States, and city parks. And you know, the Galway Bay presents an outdoor recreation opportunity, which is second to none, of course, just from the standpoint of beauty. And I noticed that you on your website, which people, if you're wanting to check this out and do, please go to CUANBEO.com and check out their website. But I noticed that you had an ongoing situation where you were talking to swimmers, and tell us about the swimming in Galway Bay.
So that's a fascinating one. So we back in 2021 there was a catchment economic assessment we produced. So that's an assessment of all the marine resources that the bay provides to the catchment, and all the kind of businesses, communities it supports. So it was rather holistic, all the different industries that are in the bay, and that are existing because of the bay, and also the cultural and social elements of what the bay provides. So one of those is swimming, and swimming has, I'm not sure what it's like over there, but in the last few years, but swimming has skyrocketed here in terms of popularity. Since COVID, actually, it was very much a people who are living along the coast within their 5 kilometer zones at the time, And swimming was a great amenity, a great hobby, at least. I know I was involved. I was swimming a lot, not as much anymore. A lot of my friends and family are still swimming every day. So the swimming, then, what we were looking at was assessing how popular it is, was the first, how regularly people are actually going, what months they're going. I'll get back to that in a moment. And then what they value at their swimming spots. So one of them, one of the highest, was water quality. That can be found,
You
by the way,
bet.
this
You bet.
swimming survey can be found in the report section of our website in the Catchment Economic Assessments. Blue with
Okay.
black, but the water quality, safety as well, various different concerns. And then we were looking at what amenities people would like to have. And interesting responses. You know, some people say, oh, we really don't want any amenities. Keep it as rough and ready as possible. We love the kind of nature of kind of jumping into the sea, and you know, we don't need any, you know, toilets or showers or anything like that. And others are saying, oh, we'd love a toilet, and we'd love a shower, and we'd love changing rooms, and we'd even like a sauna.
Well, there
So
you
all
go.
sorts of, you know, and there are a number of saunas set up in Galway Bay at swimming spots where
No
people jump
kidding.
out.
How
Yeah,
fun.
just down the road, about 2 kilometers from where I am here, is a sauna, and you go down, jump off the pier, or walk off the pier, and then you jump into the sauna and do it 3 times, and people look on like you're mad, but you're really enjoying it when you're doing it. So
So
that swimming is kind of tapping into different ways people are really using the bay and different values they have for it. And a lot of it is kind of a well-being approach of why people are swimming. And it's kind of also helping people see it in a different way, the bay, I suppose.
I take it probably kayaking and small craft sailboats was also popular, huh?
Exactly. Yeah, just
Yeah.
by that swimming spot, is a sailing club, and there's a person who runs a sauna, who also runs a kind of adventure kayaking club. I mentioned the times people are
Sure.
swimming as well of the year.
Yeah.
That's a new addition we've made to the most recent iteration of the economic assessment. And the reason for that is we're trying to gauge what drop off there is in the off season, in the non summer months. And the reason for that is to see, is there enough of a drop off for the current wastewater treatment plants to reduce their gross treatment of waste? So in certain wastewater treatment plants, they reduce or stop UV treatment in the off months.
Oh, I didn't.
So
Okay.
now that's, don't think that's the case in Galway, but what we're trying to do is get a gauge in Galway, and it might be transferable to other counties or to other places. So that they can say, well, the swimming doesn't stop. So ideally, the swimming season would be extended, and wastewater treatment would be.
So when swimming in Galway Bay, water temperatures more or less require a wetsuit, or are those that are braver than that?
No, there's some very brave ones now. I've actually never gone for a wetsuit. I've always just gone straight in. But it's funny. There's different reasons. Some people actually wear a wetsuit in the summer and go with just their swimming togs in the winter, because in the summer they don't want to be stung by maybe a jellyfish. But in the winter they love the actual cold zap. And there are no jellyfish, so they love the intensity of the cold in the winter. Now, I don't know how I feel about that, but yeah, I kind of have always just braved it either way. But
That's so fun.
I wouldn't be the most committed swimmer.
I'll never forget my very first trip to Ireland, which was in 2004. We landed in Shannon and proceeded down the coast down toward Dingle, and observed. And this was October, I think, and observed a whole bunch of surfers. And I had, in all my life, I would never have thought of surfing in Ireland. I
It's
always think of that as
quite
being
a
an
big one.
American situation, and having to have a tropical climb, to do.
Yeah,
But
there's some really nice spots along the West Coast,
you bet.
some big surfing spots in Clare and Sligo. Yeah, I remember I was friends with a person who would just go surfing for the day, and he'd just go off surfing. It's very popular. And you mentioned the temperature of the water. We actually, in collaboration with the Marine Institute in Ireland, so they are a national state agency based in Galway, but we were working on a project with them. And then as a side benefit of this project, we developed a QR code that we've placed at all the sea swimming or sea access points along Galway Bay, the coastline. And this QR code, when you scan it, you get the modeled temperature, salinity, and tidal times for that location. So say this one down the road here, 2 kilometers away from me, if I scan the QR code on the pier, I can see the predicted temperature for today, tomorrow, and later tomorrow,
Right.
the predicted temperature, and predicted salinity. And the salinity is sort of a proxy for potential pollution. If the
Right.
salinity drops, it kind of gives you an idea that, well, maybe I shouldn't swim because if there's more fresh water, there's a potential more pollution. And then the other aspect is the tidal times, which is a useful element for people because they love the high tides. And then now we're adding to those QR codes for each spot and putting in, we're linking up with the eBird Citizen Science Project, where people submit bird observations. I'm sure you've lots of citizen
Absolutely,
science there.
absolutely,
And so
absolutely.
we there's great great eBird an API where you can use the code that they've provided. And what we have now is a map that gives the most recent bird
I
observations for
love
each
that.
area.
I
Yeah,
love that. That is very
it's
cool.
actually so the Marine Institute have been really helpful in that way, and we've now got the map up, and we're hoping to add in seaweed and kind of seaweed and jellyfish identification charts as well, just to kind of provide the whole level. Yeah.
Michael, while I've got you engaged in conversation about the wildlife and conservation in Ireland, what can you say, if anything, about the salmon and the renovation of the salmon fishery in the west of Ireland? I have read about issues involving a dam or some such thing as that. What can you say about that, or can you say anything about that?
Yeah, Mark, I what I can say is rather limited.
Okay.
I would say there's quite a few salmon farms in the West Coast. There was a recent salmon farm escape, and I
Oh.
think there's a risk sometimes in these sorts of things where the media and the public can perhaps, or members of the public, well-meaning environmentalists, can maybe jump on them sometimes. In a not so productive way. So that escape, there was reports of all sorts of things. There were no disease in any of the salmon farm, in that salmon farm, or indeed any salmon farms in Ireland.
Okay.
And to that point, no actual therefore no human risk of any disease, because there was actually no disease. So sometimes I won't I don't think I can really comment any other further on salmon farms, but I think for Ireland anyways, there's quite a lot of salmon farms, but on the West Coast and around. But I think sometimes I kind of that was just a recent news story, but
Well,
I
I
suppose,
saw
yeah.
that, but I was wondering, are there native salmon which use the rivers in Ireland to spawn and such as that?
There are indeed quite a
Okay.
lot. So there's all sorts of projects underway now. There's another state agency called Inland Fisheries Ireland, and they're going about removing barriers and dams that are preventing salmon upstream movement. So the Marine Institute also has a research station in County Mayo, just north of Galway. And that has through that station goes all of the salmon going up that river, and eels as well. and going back down. So there's really good monitoring going on in and that's a really long data set. The news isn't always that positive, but it is a reflection of a lot of pressures that salmon face.
Right.
So now there's movement to remove a lot of those barriers. There's also, effects of food availability when they go back out to sea as well. And there's shifts in the timing of those kind of annual movements, and also the maturity or size of the salmon as they go back out. So I wouldn't be the most qualified, or indeed I wouldn't be qualified to speak on the salmon front. I've kind of
No, I
immersed
only br
myself in oysters for the time being.
absolutely. But I bring it up just because there are similar endeavors going on here in North America, both on the East Coast and West Coast, to reestablish salmon fisheries, which for in some instances are have not been active for 100 years or more because of dams. And they're finding that if a dam is removed, those fish will find a way into that area and make a comeback. So,
No, it's such a transferable kind of it's similar here in a lot of ways. Now the salmon fishing hasn't stopped for the, as long, but it's the same kind of result. Removal of dams has the same cause.
Well, Michael, you've been a joy to talk with, and I want to give you another opportunity to pitch any new activities or events that you've got coming up, and then we'll close. Anything that you want to say there in addition?
I suppose we're always interested in different approaches. We're certainly interested in making oyster registration more reproducible and scalable. And there are all sorts of means of doing that, and some of them are modeling the habitats that are most suitable. And indeed, a lot of the time, it's where oysters have lived before, but we're also having to account for changes in predicted temperature changes and different freshwater dynamics. So we're kind of interested on that front. We've got a lot of the groundwork done here, but we're always interested in helping other groups get going. And certainly if there are restorers over there, the assessment of what's going on and standardizing, not the restoration, but standardizing the measures of success in terms of all sorts, biodiversity, I would say some of the carbon capture elements of oyster restoration are neutral for the most part. Well, that might be the case for native oysters. Other oysters may be different, and also the nutrient cycling capacities. So we're always interested in different ways and kind of creating a framework for which oyster restoration can take place globally, in a very scalable, reproducible way, as I've said. So we're exploring projects along those lines, and also wider scale, regional, restoration projects of the marine. So Galway Bay, it would be great to have a whole scale, restoration project, or, we could even rephrase it as rewilding if we want to enter that fray of terms. But, there's really a great appetite over here in Ireland, and there's now legislation coming down and regulations that require restoration and the mechanisms for it to be performed. So it's really positive in that way. I guess I'm relatively new to the arena, and I'd be quite optimistic, albeit sometimes naive, but I'd still kind of realize that things take time, but it is quite encouraging, really, the amount of dialogue that's now happening at all levels of communities, citizens, whichever government departments and agencies. It's kind of really gearing up, so it's quite positive in that way, right?
Super. And it sounds like you're looking for collaborators and wherever you can find them.
Exactly. Yeah. No,
Exactly.
it's really positive. And there's so many different ways of achieving goals, and different goals as well. We're restoring a fishery, But we're also restoring the habitat it provides and the ecosystem services. So there's all sorts of levels there. We'd have a management plan that allows fishing, but we'll also prioritize the ecosystem functioning and wider ecosystem services of the oyster bed and reefs. So yeah, we're always interested in different perspectives.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time today and speaking with us, and thanks again for your patience in getting this all arranged. And
Thank you, Mark. No, it's great to join you. Great to
I
join you.
wish you
Thank
the
you.
best in your endeavors,
Thank
and
you.
thank you again.
Thank you.